All right, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here all the way from the physics department, you know, a few hundred meters away. But so I'm not really going to be talking about 3D gravity. I'm, of course, going to be talking about four-dimensional Einstein gravity, specifically that which we were introduced to yesterday by Jeffrey, this idea of looking at the near-horizon limit of an extremal Kerr black hole and studying that in the same way that we do ADS CFT. What we're going to discover is, despite this being a four-dimensional theory of gravity, there really are going to be no dynamics, not because there are kind of in the wave equation there are no non-gauge propagating modes, but the propagating modes will just destroy any idea we had of a extremal Kerr throw geometry. So to remind ourselves of what we saw yesterday, if you take the near horizon geometry of an extremal Kerr, you look at basically the throat region zooming in on the horizon, and you get this thing that is called the neck geometry for near horizon extremal Kerr. This was all really reviewed by Jeffrey yesterday, so I don't want to go into too much detail. But you see, all you're left with is one length scale R0, which is just related to the angular momentum of the black hole you started with, but you can, of course, scale it to zero. You see, I don't know how far down people can see on this. One important thing to point out is that the killing vectors that we have are, we have rotation, time translation. This is the metric written in Poincaré coordinates. We only cover the Poincaré patch. So there's time translation, there's the scaling symmetry, much like ADS2, and we also have a global time translation, much like ADS2. And we're going to see this analogy with near-horizon Kerr behaving a lot like near-horizon extremal Reisner Nordstrom, ADS2 cross S2, is going to bias a lot. And so it's worth pointing out here that, as Jeffrey told us, there's a SL2R cross U1 isometry of for this metric. So what did we learn yesterday? We learned that there's this fun procedure where if you look at this geometry and you find boundary conditions such that the asymptotic symmetry group contains a Virasoro algebra, you can calculate the central charge of that algebra. You can look at the Frolov-Thorin temperature for basically free fields in this background, and use Cardy's formula to calculate the entropy of, you know, quote unquote, a conformal field theory, and see that that entropy formula agrees with the entropy for the black hole, just the horizon area over 4. But there are a lot of mysteries about Kerr CFT. So one mystery you might think of is that if you're really going to use Cardy's formula, you need to be starting with a modular invariant conformal field theory. And in that context, Cardy's formula is counting a density of states at a highly excited level about some ground state. And this is what we have for the BTZ black hole, right? The BTZ black hole is some excited state about just the ADS vacuum. But we're saying that the neck geometry has an entropy and it has a temperature, so it's in some sense an excited state. So if it's the excited state, what is the ground state of the CFT in terms of this picture? Another question is just one of stability, which is of course related to this idea of the neck being an excited state, which is that, of course, asymptotically flat rotating black holes exhibit super radiance. If you if you hit the black hole with a wave of any field or any bosonic field, you can get more amplitude out than you put in. Now, if you imagine taking your Kerr black hole and you put it in a box, this super radiance is of course going to lead to an instability, because you bounce a wave off the black hole, it comes back with bigger amplitude, but then it bounces off your reflecting box and, you know, repeats and repeats, and this will just exponentially diverge. So Kerr in a box, which is a lot like what taking this near horizon geometry and then applying some sort of symplectic flux conserving boundary conditions to that geometry is basically doing. So you might expect that then this neck geometry will be unstable.
Does that instability apply to ADS Kerr?
Does that instability apply to ADS Kerr? Absolutely. So in ADS Kerr, there's this story of super radiance there, where ADS Kerr is indeed unstable to forming some basically halo of gravitons rotating around it. Roberto Imperon and other people have written papers about this specifically, I think. But I don't I don't want to get into it, but yeah, it does happen there. And so, of course, if you look at, you could expect that if you looked at the near horizon geometry of ADS Kerr, you'd again expect instabilities there as well. So what am I going to talk about? Well, we're going to try to study kind of asymptotically neck geometries to try to get a feel for what's in there in this realm of geometries with these boundary conditions to help us probe the CFT. So the two things we're going to do is first, we're going to study linearized perturbations of this, the neck background, not just Kerr. And I'm going to tell you about doing this for a massless scalar field. You can, of course, do the equivalent computations for graviton fluctuations, and they end up being really identical, but you have to go through a lot of hoops to show that. It's not a spherically symmetric spacetime, it's not static, and so it's not obvious that wave equations separate, and just the wave equations for metric fluctuations don't separate and all the modes mix. But in the 70s, Tucholsky basically came up with this very clever method using the Newman-Penrose formalism to get a separable wave equation so that people could really study radiation from Kerr and all of these things. And it turns out that you can basically take all of that analysis of basically studying wave equations outside asymptotically flat Kerr and just take the near horizon limit, and there you go. You have the separated wave equation. But today we're just going to focus on scalar fields because the results are basically identical and it's a lot cleaner with the scalar field. The second thing we're going to talk about is back reaction effects, because of course you know that if you have some finite energy density in a gravitational theory, you expect that nonlinearities are going to give you back reaction. So in flat space, of course, if you have some lump of energy, your constraints are going to force you to have a 1 over r tail in your metric that's just telling you that you have some energy density. And what we're going to find is that these back reaction effects are going to heavily constrain the system to the point that we will get to our conclusion, which is there are really no bulk dynamics in the neck geometry. So, part one, we're going to just study a massless scalar in the neck geometry. And as I said, while it's not spherically symmetric or static, you can still show that the wave equation separates. So we just have a massless scalar field, and we can decompose it with some harmonic time and phi dependence, where phi is our axisymmetric coordinate. And you get just a ugly wave equation. It's not terribly enlightening to look at it. The important things to point out is that the angular equation is a it's a finite deformation of regular spherical harmonics. And so this is just an eigenvalue problem you have to solve. You basically solve it numerically. And you see that the eigenvalues are close to spherical harmonic eigenvalues. They're slightly deformed away, being L times L plus 1. The important thing to point out is that you look at this radial equation, you study it at large radius, and you see that as r goes to infinity, you get r to some power law, and that power law is minus a half plus or minus the square root of something messy, and we're going to define this quantity here to be this quantity mu, and so we're going to say that the scalar fields fall off as minus a half plus or minus mu. And this is really very analogous to Andy de Sitter space, where you always find the same behavior. You have usually a normalizable and non-normalizable mode for certain values of the mass. Both modes are normalizable. You can consider more complicated boundary conditions.
Seems that your both angular momentum and mass depends on the angular momentum or something.
Exactly. That's right. So it depends on your spherical harmonic. And so you see that there's some critical value of the eigenvalue of the spherical mode, 2m squared minus a quarter, which is like the Breitlander-Freeman bound, which is where this quantity inside here changes sign. And so if k is below this bound, you see that you have imaginary fall off. And that's just like an Andy de Sitter space when you have a scalar field below the BF bound. And so since we see, and you can very quickly throw this on a computer and kind of find some eigenvalues and see that, lo and behold, there are indeed eigenvalues that are below this critical value. So there are quote-unquote unstable modes. And the question is, are they really unstable modes at the level of the linearized theory?
Sorry, an immediate question. There's no parameter in your solution. The mass of the black hole and the charge can be scaled away.
Well, so you have that R naught that I had written down in the metric, and we just scaled it to 1. And in the rest of this, I'm setting R naught to 1 because it just makes life easier. You can, of course, scale it back in. But yes, that's absolutely correct. There are no scales in the problem. So, what do we want to do when we want to look for instabilities? We have to play the same game that we play in anti-de Sitter space. Well, first of all, to have well-defined classical evolution, we have to make sure that our symplectic current is conserved. For a scalar field, that's just the Klein-Gordon current. And this is what we usually remember. You want to make sure that you don't have any Klein-Gordon flux going in and out of your boundary of ADS or in and out of your boundary of the neck geometry. Otherwise, you don't have well-defined energy isn't conserved, and so forth. So again, a lot like ADS2, I mean, a lot of this is really just power counting, and the power counting works out just like ADS2. You do the power counting and you say, well, normalizability, if that parameter mu is greater than 1, the only normalizable mode is the fast falloff mode. So this is like the BF bound plus 1. When mu is imaginary, or it's between 0 and 1, both modes are normalizable, and so you can consider more complicated combinations of them. Now, what we want to make sure to have good classical evolution is we want to have conservation of the symplectic flux. And you just go through the calculation and you see that for real mu modes, if you take a particular fluctuation that is just some linear combination of the slow falloff and fast falloff modes, then here I'm assuming that I'm in this bottom case here, because otherwise for fast falloff mode you only have Dirichlet boundary conditions and flux is kind of trivially conserved. You see that there's some constraint on this parameter alpha to make sure we have no symplectic flux through the boundary. And so for real mu, it's just that alpha has to be a real number, and for imaginary mu, alpha has to be pure phase. And this calculation, you can again reproduce it for spin 2 fluctuations, and it's basically identical, though it's a lot more complicated to find the result. And again, this is really an analogy to anti de Sitter space. But I should mention briefly that in anti de Sitter space, it's kind of easier to show that once you have a scalar field below the BF bound, that your theory is unstable. Because since anti de Sitter space is a static space-time, if you have a scalar field below the BF bound, you can construct initial data that has negative energy. And since it's a static space-time, you know that you can have it be arbitrarily negative energy. And so energy is unbounded from below, and it's just an unstable system. But here, since it's not static, you can't do that quite as quickly. So we have to go hop through a few more hoops to show that these quote-unquote unstable modes really are unstable. But it's not too hard to do. So what boundary conditions do we have for the scalar fields? Well, we have one boundary condition at r equals infinity, which is conservation of flux. For real frequency modes, you have a continuous spectrum because we're working on Poincaré coordinates. If we worked in global coordinates, there would be two boundary conditions at the two boundaries of the spacetime, and you'd get a quantized spectrum. But what we want to look at is frequencies in the upper half plane, because those are the exponentially growing modes that tell us we have an instability. And we see that if you look at the wave equation, you find that given that the scalar field has this behavior, this particular behavior near the horizon, this gives you a second boundary condition at the Poincaré horizon for complex frequency modes. You grind this through your equations, and you see that for quantization of these unstable modes, you say that, well, if your frequency has some particular phase theta, this theta has to take this form, which lies between 0 and pi. And so at the end of the day, you show that there are indeed unstable modes. There are modes of the scalar field with frequencies in the upper half plane. So in the linearized theory, those can just occur, grow exponentially, and your theory seems very unstable.
And I didn't understand what boundary conditions you put at r equals 0.
At r equals 0, I have to put boundary conditions only for complex frequency modes, which is that I want it to be a regular solution. I want to make sure that I have the, for upper half plane, I got the minus sign. So it dies out at the horizon, it doesn't blow up. And so at the end of the day, you get this complicated formula, and something that surprised the hell out of me was that you do the same calculation for spin 2 perturbations. It's very complicated, it's very messy, and you get this exact same formula for where your frequencies have to lie in the complex plane. And so what do you see? You see that when you're looking at where your quasi-normal modes are, you just have a line of them in the complex plane, and they're, you know, quantized in some series, but there are an infinite number of them. And this is just for some particular value of theta. For every spherical harmonic, which gives us a mu, which is imaginary, we're going to have an infinite number of them. So there are lots of instabilities in this linearized theory. So, you know, you could do the same calculation for anti-de Sitter space when you have a when you have a scalar field with a mass below the BF bound, and you find basically the same thing. That, you know, of course, the theory is unstable. The second question that we want to talk about is the question of back reaction, and what does that really mean? We want to know how we can put finite energy in a spacetime that's asymptotically this neck geometry, right? Because we expect from the constraints, if we have some linearized perturbation that isn't specifically chosen to have finite, to have zero energy, it's the constraints in the full nonlinear theory are going to have to force it to have some sort of, you might expect, Coulomb-like tail. So our first attempt to put finite energy in the neck geometry is to just look for finite temperature solutions. So you can think of an analogy, the black D3 brain. If you take an extremal D3 brain, take the near horizon limit, you get AdS5 cross S5. But if you take the appropriate double scaling limit where you scale the temperature to zero and you zoom in close to the horizon in the appropriate way, you can actually recover AdS Schwarzschild, which has finite energy above the AdS5 cross S5 background. But in the neck geometry, this fails. What do you say? You say, let's introduce some non-extremality parameter. This should be epsilon tilde squared, which is just m squared minus a squared. And so in neck coordinates, your temperature is now, well, it's going to be some epsilon tilde divided by lambda times other things. And so we know that how we need to scale our temperature to zero is basically we're going to have to scale this epsilon tilde like lambda epsilon. And you say, well, okay, then what is the charge with respect to ddt in the neck coordinates? And, well, it goes to zero in this limit. So you have solutions that are at finite temperature, but they have zero energy, which is a little strange.
And the asymptote is,
they asymptote to the neck geometry. And, in fact, it's even stronger than that. They don't just asymptote to the neck geometry. The finite temperature solution is actually diffeomorphic to the neck geometry. There's just a diffeomorphism you can write down. So the finite temperature coordinates cover a finite temperature patch up here, and you see that their time translation is really just the Poincaré rescaling Killing vector in the solution. This is exactly analogous to AdS2 cross S2, and in fact, the way you find this diffeomorphism is you just take the AdS2 diffeomorphism and plug it in, and it works. So let's remind ourselves, since this is so analogous to AdS2 cross S2, what happens in AdS2 cross S2? Well, in AdS2 cross S2, the constraints cause any finite energy density to basically destroy the asymptotic AdS2 structure. Said more strongly, you can use the Birkhoff theorem for Einstein-Maxwell gravity, and you know that the only spherically symmetric solutions are either asymptotically flat Reisner-Nordstrom black holes or AdS2 cross S2. You just can't put finite energy in AdS2. It destroys the asymptotics of the spacetime. And since things are behaving so much like AdS2 cross S2 in this neck geometry, we're willing to make the following conjecture, that any non-zero SL2R charge density will destroy the neck asymptotics. Now, why that's the SL2R charge density and not just energy density, I'll explain it right here. But the other conjecture is that the only stationary axisymmetric asymptotically neck solution is going to be the neck geometry itself, either in global coordinates for no horizon, in Poincaré coordinates for an extremal horizon, or in the finite temperature coordinates for a regular horizon. And I think as of this morning, Gary is close to a proof of this statement, but it's, you know, it's tentative, but it seems very, very likely. So, why do we really care about the full SL2R charge and not just energy density? Well, as I said on the previous slide, there are three coordinate systems, right? And in Poincaré coordinates, time translation is one particular generator of SL2R. In global coordinates, time translation is another generator. And in the finite temperature, of course, time translation is the third generator of SL2R. And so since all three generators of SL2R are really time translations, if you have any charge density for any of these SL2R generators, you'd expect that any charge density would, again, backreact and destroy the asymptotics if you really satisfy the constraints. And there's an analogous statement, of course, for ADS2 cross S2 that you can't, it's not just that you can't have finite energy density, you can't have finite rescaling charge either. So what does that mean? Well, you can say, well, okay, before we had thought, well, maybe we'll just combine, we'll construct initial data packets such that, we'll construct linearized solutions with zero energy, then we don't have to worry about them back reacting. Well, can you construct, well, and then you could also imagine, well, since we have to set these other charges to zero, you construct combinations that have zero charge under all three of these charges. But that's good for an initial data surface, but you have to make sure that all three of those charges are conserved. And it turns out that they're not. By construction, basically, conservation of symplectic flux gives you energy conservation. But conservation for the other SL2R charges, you look at the flux for the other SL2R charges, and you just find that, for instance, for the unstable modes, it's manifestly non-zero. So these other charges are just not conserved. And why are they not conserved? Well, they're not conserved because our unstable modes, to have no symplectic flux going through the boundary for our unstable modes, we have to impose boundary conditions that breaks, for instance, the rescaling charge. So it's not surprising that since we're explicitly breaking that symmetry, well, the charge just isn't conserved anymore. Well, this looks bad, but you might ask, can we fix this by kind of appropriately combining various modes? Because, for instance, we have this symmetry where we change the angular momentum of our packet, we invert the sphere, and mu stays the same. So perhaps, maybe, some combination of a plus m mode and a minus m mode with the same mu eigenvalue can cancel this flux, and so for this subsector, we will have conservation of charge. And unfortunately, the answer is no. If you try to calculate the flux of that linear combination for, say, the unstable modes, you just find that it is some manifestly non-zero positive definite quantity, and you find the same result again for spin 2 modes. So you can't really restrict to some subclass of modes where all of these charges are conserved. They're just not conserved. And as I said, that's because we're imposing boundary conditions that breaks the symmetry. So what does this tell us? It tells us that if we take some initial data on for which all three the charge is zero for all three charges, this will evolve to some time slice where the charge is not zero because the charges just aren't conserved. And so what does this tell us? This really tells us that only, phi equals zero is going to be compatible with the constraints in the full nonlinear backreacted problem. And a similar result holds for metric perturbations. And our outcome is basically that there are no bulk dynamics that are compatible with the constraints for the neck geometry. That's very surprising. It is just it's a four-dimensional problem, and it's not like you have any good reason to expect these things to just have to be squashed, but that's what happens. So what have we seen? We've seen that despite going through this process, studying linearized modes, everything in the linearized theory seems reasonably well behaved. But once you start considering the nonlinear theory and back reaction with gravity, you quickly come to the conclusion that it appears as though there are no dynamical degrees of freedom in the neck geometry. You just can't have any propagating bulk degrees of freedom. Now, for the original Kerr CFT work, with their boundary conditions, what this will mean is that you only have boundary graviton diffeomorphisms. You have diffeomorphisms that are large enough at the large enough at infinity that they'll have zero energy, but they'll change the Virasoro charges. But that's it. There's really no bulk dynamics. But really what we've seen is it doesn't matter what boundary conditions you pick. You're never going to be able to cook up boundary conditions that allow for finite energy in the neck geometry. Another thing that I'll just briefly point out, because it was something that was discussed in a talk I think a week or two ago, was that if you take the natural boundary conditions that you expect from the metric perturbations, you say, well, I look at metric perturbations, I study their fall off, and I use that as a method for basically guessing what I expect to be good boundary conditions, you find not this Virasoro algebra out of the U1 that was found in the original Kerr CFC paper, but you find this infinite dimensional algebra that's an extension of the SL2R symmetry, this Galilean conformal algebra. But of course, to avoid back reaction, all of these charges, of course, have to vanish as well, just like the SL2R charges had to vanish. And here it's even more explicit because here we're allowing for arbitrary time dependence. So if it's a, I mean, it really wouldn't make sense for that to be conserved and non-zero. So again, we're seeing that this is very much like ADS2, and this whole neck geometry, a lot of analogies have been made between the neck geometry and ADS3 and BTZ black holes, and I think the lesson to take away from this is that a much better analogy is with ADS2 cross S2. You really have something that looks like an ADS2 geometry with a sphere that stays constant size as you move towards the boundary, and a lot of the results from ADS2 happen here as well. Now, this leaves a big question, but what are the consequences for the CFT? Because as we said, the CFT is supposedly counting states in some highly excited state, but we've just argued that you can't really have any other energy in the system. And so if the neck geometry is the highly excited state, what is a highly excited state of? I think there isn't, at this point, a clear answer to that question. There are lots of other questions that you can ask about the CFT, but for purposes of time, I'll stop here. Thank you.
The original KCFT, they posed that there was an extremality condition that one of the SL2R charges has to be zero.
Yeah.
And the other charges somehow were not discussed or not contained in the phase space.
So,
what was the thing? Did it change?
There's a small minor mistake in that original paper, which is the following. So they claim that their boundary conditions only find in the asymptotic symmetry group basically this generator of the SL2R, the time translation, and that's actually incorrect. The rescaling generator is also in their asymptotic symmetry group, and so you'd expect that for these reasons of back reaction, both of these charges need to be set to zero for that construction.
And the third one is not included?
Yeah, the boundary conditions that they impose explicitly breaks this symmetry.
What is the way to generalize them?
Well, I mean, depending on what coordinate system you're in, any three of these generators is a time translation. So it's a question of what coordinate system you're in. However, given that we have an argument that these are all charges and the charge has to vanish for any solution, and so that means by definition they're actually gauge symmetry generators. And so, I haven't thought about it too carefully what it means for the third SL2R generator in terms of Andy's boundary conditions. But I'm not sure.
Are you saying that Psi2 and Psi3 form a two-parameter subgroup of SL2R?
Yeah, it's like L0 and L+.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a close sub algebra. Yeah.
So, in the first part of your talk, you said that the background was unstable.
I say that in the linearized theory, it's unstable, yes.
And you expect that instability to persist? So it's unstable, right?
No, sorry. So that's the key point, is that the linearized theory is unstable, but all of those modes, you would expect the back reaction from having any of those modes turned on, the constraints would destroy the asymptotic neck geometry. So they can't be in a consistent phase space. So the end result is that even though it looks like there are these instabilities related to super radiance, in a consistent phase space for the neck geometry, they're really just not there. And the phase space is just these boundary gravitons.
So boundary conditions project them away?
I would say that the constraints requiring that the system be asymptotically neck projects them away.
Right, that's the boundary.
Yeah.
Here's a subtlety which should be explained. I mean, Matt said this in just the thing that he said in clarifying, in contrast with some of the things we heard about chirography. The story here is that there is initial data that appears to be perfectly consistent with neck asymptotics. The issue is that, as you can imagine, that the data is confined to some small region. The issue is that at some finite time, it propagates to the boundary, and then it wants to change the asymptote. So you have to impose the boundary conditions not just on an initial time slice, but you have to, that if you take the point of view that you want this boundary condition to be maintained for all time, and then you work backwards to find out the initial data that maintains it for all time, that removes the asymptote.
That's a very unnatural. Yes.
So good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Sorry about my voice. I guess it's better now. But if I start to hoarse out towards the end of the talk, please let me know and I'll talk louder. All right. So today I'm going to talk about chiral supergravity. It's an extension of chiral gravity, which is kind of a special point in topologically massive gravity, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So I'll try to gloss over the gravity details and focus mostly on the super part. Okay. Move on. So what was the motivation for the work that we did? Supersymmetry can make things more transparent, but at the time that we started our work, there were some opaque issues with topologically massive gravity, particularly when Andy and friend's paper first came out about chiral gravity, which is a candidate gravity dual to a chiral CFT. So our first concerns that we looked at was the positivity of energy. We had questions about that in theory, because there were some questions about ghosts in the theory, which there's been a lot more developments in that area. But anyway, other concerns we had were about boundary conditions and instabilities. There was this notion of a log mode, which we can come to discuss. And perhaps the most pressing concern and the biggest part of today's talk will be, does a chiral supergravity theory even exist? And so that's what I hope to address. Okay, so the overview for the talk. I'm going to give a lightning review of 2+1 dimensional gravity for those of you who may have missed out on anything. Then talk primarily about topologically massive supergravity. Talk about the linear modes that we found and the conserved charges of those modes. And then give some future directions. So some quick things about 2+1 dimensional gravity. First, no bulk dynamics. The metric is frozen in, at least in the bulk. ADS has black holes. ADS has boundary dynamics. So if you add a cosmological constant that's negative, you get some really interesting physics. There are some higher derivative extensions. If you extend it with a Chern-Simons term, the action that is, you get topologically massive gravity. Recently, if you extend it with an R-squared term, you get new massive gravity, which has two massive gravitons, which is exciting in its own way, but I won't be talking about that any further. Some people about 2 years ago began to talk about the partition function of 2+1 dimensional gravity. Witten put out a paper where he had a had a conjecture about what the partition function should be and had some really exciting properties, including symmetry properties. But then Witten required an assumption of holomorphic factorization, but Witten and Maloney came around and said, well, they can't really holomorphically factorize. But then more recently, Maloney, Song, and Strominger showed up and said, no holomorphic factorization of the partition function is necessary if you have chiral gravity, because you already have only a right mover. That's what we'll be talking about today, chiral gravity, which is topologically massive gravity, a special point in parameter space, which we'll come to discuss, although I'm sure you're all familiar with it by now, at mu L equals to 1. So anyway, that was the lightning review. Now, in the literature, there's some definitions and terms, and people like to use different things. There's a whole lot of questions. So I thought I'd like to just kind of set us all on the same page, at least for right now. So there's topologically massive gravity, which is generally abbreviated TMG. You can extend that to cosmologically topologically massive gravity, CTMG. And following Nicholas and Johansson, Grumiller and Johansson, chiral cosmologically topologically massive gravity, CCTMG. And then there's this other kind of notion where in the old days, in the 80s, topologically massive gravity was defined with a Newton constant that was negative for reasons that are not entirely important, although they're kind of interesting. We can discuss them later. So we might call that OMG. And so now we are going to be discussing the supersymmetrized version of all of that. So is it necessary really to start talking about cosmology? Anyway, so no, we're just going to be talking about topologically massive supergravity. What I want to point out is that we will assume a negative cosmological constant at all points. We will assume that the Newton's constant is greater than zero, right? So it's consistent with physics that we know and love. And also, for that matter, I should point out that mu will also be considered to be positive. And when I talk about the chiral point, there will be some parameters, which we'll get to. This just means that I'm at this point in parameter space, okay? All right, so if you want to get involved with this sort of work, I just want to caution you in the beginning, or to help you out. The most confusing point, I think, of the entire work that we did was notions of parity. So if you have questions, that's probably where they're going to be. I thought I'd just point that out. All right, so let's begin. Topologically massive supergravity popped in just shortly after topologically massive gravity was developed by Desser, Yakif, and Templeton. So Desser and K, sorry, the site is not up there, extended it to a supersymmetric case. Note the Reuter-Schwinger term with a mass term in supergravity. The gravitino field necessarily picks up a mass, and that mass is fixed by supersymmetry to be 1/2 L, where, again, L is the anti-de Sitter radius. There's also the fermionic equivalent of the Chern-Simons term, which is written here, and I, of course, sorry, you need to know that. F is kind of like the dual in three dimensions of the field strength of the fermion. Using the Levi-Civita tensor. Other things I should point out is now that we are in a supersymmetric case, we pick up some torsion due to fermion terms, and that torsion comes in the spin connection, and it's written just like this here with the fields. That makes life very complicated when you move to nonlinear terms. So if you carefully stare at this for a while, you begin to realize that what you're actually talking about with this action. Before I mention that, there's some parity odd terms, and this is why it's important. So the parity odd terms is the Chern-Simons term and the fermionic equivalent of the Chern-Simons term. But also, interestingly enough, the mass term for the gravitino field is parity odd, and that will have some interesting consequences that led to some confusion. But we'll talk about that more. But it's carefully staring at this and associated with, this parity oddness of the mass term, we realize that we're looking at a n equals 1, 0 theory. So in other words, if we want to have something quite similar to what Andy and friends first proposed, we need to start looking at a n equals 1, 1 theory. And all that requires, you might see Arturo and Townsend for n equals pq supergravity theory, not topologically massive, just supergravity. All it requires us is to add another field in, right? So now we have to add a left-moving gravitino and a right-moving gravitino. Note parity, oddness of these various terms. That's important. I should also point out that this action is not parity invariant now, even though that we've added right and left moving fermions, because once again, Chern-Simons term is parity odd, and while the mass doublet will flip under parity, you also get this kind of, in other words, the mu goes to minus mu behavior that you are familiar with from topologically massive gravity pops up again. And the Fermion coupling, you pick up two of the contributions, just a linear sum of the two contributions they had before in the Fermion. So I'll just schematically represent them as kappa. So anyway, you might want to call it the contortion. So anyway, some details about the theory that may not be interesting. Anyway, there's a torsional constraint on the spin connection that just the bosonic part of the spin connection. It's the usual kind of thing. But now that we have fermions, what's important is you have this metricity condition. So now you have I should point out we're working in the second order formalism, which means that you fix your spin connection from the supergravity perspective. So you write down the spin connection however you want to drive it, one and a half order formalism just from supergravity. You write down what your spin connection is, and then you define your spin connection for the higher derivative theory to be that. So that's defined from us from ordinary n equals 1, 1 supergravity. This condition here just basically defines for you the torsional Christoffel symbol. Anyway, not very interesting. So there's some supersymmetry transformations, and again, because we're working in second-order formalism, the supersymmetry transformations for the spin connection are fixed ahead of time. It's a long and complicated, not very illuminating thing, so I left it out. But there's references to see. Anyway, you have field equations, so the new field equation we have is for the gravitational fields. This is the F defined earlier. There is, however, due to the Chern-Simons piece, the fermionic Chern-Simons term, you now pick up a fermionic term in the bosonic field equation just by varying the action with respect to the field bind. It's not important, I guess, really what the full, is it full, it's nonlinear, it's gross, we'll talk about it maybe if you want. Anyway, Cotton tensor, as you're probably familiar with. Now we have the Cottino vector spinner, right, which just picks up more terminology, largely. Anyway, but we're not really interested in those for this talk. We're interested in the linearized field equations. So in the linearized field equations, we don't have to worry about terms like this because they're higher order in nature. So this is the usual case, right? This is the 3Ds acting on your first order metric perturbation. And here is our similar field equation for the fermions. This is more like the Dirac equation for the gravitational fields. But anyway, these are effectively your field equations for your linearized modes. So let's talk a little bit about, we talk about linearized modes, but what are we linearizing around? Right, you have to perturb around some vacuum. So our vacuum will be anti-de Sitter space, as you might expect. Anyway, there's our metric and the usual coordinate systems, the normal coordinate systems everyone's been using. You have the Killing vectors. We've rewritten them a little bit from the literature just to write them in terms of taus and phis, because we like taus and phis.
That's the way it's a supersymmetric solution?
It is, absolutely. Absolutely supersymmetric with vanishing fermions and the vacuum. Anyway, so our perturbations, so the perturbations is just as per usual. H, which will be a transverse traceless two tensor, you know, as per usual. Our metric perturbation, so a perturbation around zero, if you like, is psi, and it's going to be a gamma traceless vector spinner. These are our gauge conditions, right? This just defines what kind of fields we'll be interested in. And anyway, linearized fields will fall into the lowest weight representations of ADS3 associated with the various spins, and I'll get to what I mean by that. Now, the easiest way to do this, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this kind of stuff already. Anyway, so you kind of confuse the Killing vector with the lead derivative. So if you were to take a lead derivative of what do I mean? So your lead derivative, a general lead derivative, say L of n for some Killing vector k, is an operator that acts on your mode, and here it is. Right, everything is this. All these nablas are supposed to be taken with respect to the background, right? So you covariant derivatives with respect to ADS3. Similarly, you can define something for the lead derivative for some vector k on your vector spinners. So anyway, we pick up our Killing vectors. We take for some state, be it graviton or gravitino, right? You have your lowest weight primary field conditions here, L1 or n greater than 0 must vanish. L0, this defines for you your weights. But once again, we switched out the u's and v's for e, you know, u's and v's for taus and phis. And similarly with that, we switched out the h's and the h bars for e's and s's, energy and spin weights. They turned out to be a little bit more transparent, I think, in what we try to do. So anyway, we're dealing with a supersymmetric case. So we have Killing vectors, we also have Killing spinners. So what are the Killing spinners then? Well, you can just do a similar thing. You have a lead derivative with some vector field k, and you just define that vector field k to be gamma mu times that that Killing spinner.
So how many Killing spinners do you have?
You have, so in N11 case, you have 4. Yeah, and I don't have them in there. Maybe they're coming. Anyway, I can write those down for you if you like. Anyway, so you use these operators and they define your bulk isometry algebra, right, in the usual sort of way, only now we have fermions to deal with. And the reason why you want to think about them as Lie derivatives maybe is because at the level of Lie derivatives, these are just Lie brackets, so you can check the algebra fairly easily. There's two, right? This is just the left moving side, but you also consider the right moving side where you put bars on everybody. Anyway, so the hope, right, the logic behind what we're trying to do here is that you can extend this to a boundary algebra on the boundary, so there should be a super conformal field theory on the boundary side. And essential charges, again, were given a long time ago. So there's the Brown-Hanau part, here's the Krauss and Larson part. And so Hanau and friends had published a paper a while ago which suggested that the central charges are the same in the supersymmetric case, although that can be checked through the explicit kind of things that people have been talking about for a while, so I'll spare you that. Anyway, so one thing I should point out, I guess, is that we have linearized modes. I wasn't sure how much time that we'll have. So I have them. I can write them down for you if you want. We can discuss them. So feel free to ask for them at any time. Same thing with the Killing spinners. Anyway, so now let's talk a little bit about conserved charges. So again, this is probably not new to most of you. This has been what the topic of the week, right? So following Abbott and Deser and Tekin for topologically massive gravity, you can kind of repackage your full nonlinear field equations in this way, so that you take the linear points, linear parts. So this is the cosmologically extended Einstein tensor. Here's the to first order. Here's the first order Cotton tensor, and then you take everything else, all your nonlinear terms, and you cram them into something that you define to be just P, right? And you call that your stress energy tensor associated with the linear mode. So in some similar sense, you can do that. So if your linear fermion field equation, which we already discussed, for the gravitational fields, you can split it up into that, and then you just cram everything else, all the nonlinear bits, into J, which is your supercurrent, your effective supercurrent, right? So in this sense, now you can interpret the nonlinear terms in the field equations as sources for the linear modes. Fairly straightforward. And so this is the usual kind of thing that you can do to kind of analyze these modes. So anyway, we did this, right? So we wrote out the modes out, and this is nasty stuff that you get out. So some of this may look familiar. This is the stuff that Andy and friends have already done. Okay, so what happens, as I pointed out earlier, there is a new term in the field equations that is nonlinear in nature that you get from the contribution of the gravitational fields to your bosonic equations of motion. So to second order, so this is all to second order, you pick up new terms. So as you see, they depend on the gravitinos themselves, but you notice they have this kind of suspicious behavior, right? And I can talk about a little bit about the suspicious behavior. It's a little bit different, it's a bit odd, but not to worry, we'll talk about where it comes from. And it's worth pointing out that these contributions here come from the variation of the mass term for the gravitational field with respect to the field line. So, and that will play an important role in what we have to say in a few slides. Anyway, repeating the analysis, once again, you get a horrible looking mess, but you do the same thing effectively to the supercharger. So again, this is to second order. So now you get two bits of terms. This term here, well, I guess they kind of come from bits of both, but this comes from the kinetic term of the Reuter-Schwinger field, right? And then these will come from all the other contributions, so the mass term and the topological bit. I guess progress on. So you'll notice some very similar behavior, and if you're quick about putting in mu's L is equal to 1, you can do your own analysis. Some things I should point out, these spin connections now are to first order in those linear metric perturbations, so it's a very complicated disgusting mess. So you might be wondering, well, wait, isn't Andy say something about mu L squared? Where's the mu L squared minus 1, something like that? Well, that's hiding in here. The spin connections that depend on the massive graviton mode pick up some things. But you know what? All of that really isn't terribly interesting because the chiral point, everything kind of simplifies a bit, and that's all you're left with. So the conserved charges and left for the energy, supercharge, both vanish. Massive ones vanish. And all you're left with are these two pieces. This is from the this is the, you know, the usual case from the bosons. All the fermion contributions, because they came from the mass term, right? They're parity odd, so they vanish. So this comes just from the kinetic term for the right to Schwinger field, so it still stays around. So the important point here is not only did we find that the at least to second order, the theory is chiral, but all the contributions to the conserved quantities that come from parity odd terms in the action completely disappear. So it's not only chiral, it's kind of, you know, well, maybe that's obvious, but it's cute to me. It seems like it's very strongly enforcing this notion that, yes, a supergravity theory does exist for this topologically massive case, and it is chiral, which is nice. Because, you know, ordinarily when we first started this kind of analysis, it seemed like, oh, we're just, you know, following the same exact steps that Andy and friends followed, just for a different spin, right? So they're just, it's kind of the same dance, just different objects. But that parity odd mass term really took us for a spin and led to some interesting kind of results. So anyway, that's...
Your linearized analysis was an arbitrary mu-l?
Arbitrary mu-l.
So I'm confused. I thought ADS3 was unstable at arbitrary mu-l.
It is, yes.
But it's also supersymmetric, you said.
But it at the chiral point. So I have ADS is a solution, right? Okay, ADS is a solution to topologically massive supergravity at any point from mu l. That's the statement.
But it's supersymmetric
only for vanishing gravitational in the background fermion fields. Yeah.
The Killing spin is disappearing, mu l is not one.
Yeah, sorry?
The Killing spin is disappearing, mu l is not one.
No, they should still. They're.
Is the Killing spin is any?
No, they should still be there. I know that they still solve the same.
But if the Killing spin is one.
The Killing spinner should not be dependent on values of mu. So you're talking about different backgrounds, right? So if we talk about ADS background, the Killing spinners are properties of the background. They have nothing to do with your point in parameter space, right?
Actually, I think the statement in 1.0 is that if the background has a nil Killing vector, then it has square symmetry. It is square symmetry.
And
why are you
true about the Kronecker theorem?
It's
ghosts.
Yeah, yes.
And the bosonic theory has
the ghost. And so that's why you don't have. So the perturbations, right? The perturbations are not. You know, there's no. You can't make sense of it at away from the chiral point. But for the vacuum, it's another. Anyway.
That's a super symmetric solution for all values.
Right, absolutely. So you plug it into the field equation, you get zero. Good.
But is it super symmetric? Yeah.
Yes.
What?
Yeah. Yes.
It's super symmetric?
Yes. Yeah.
And yet it's unstable?
Yes.
Because of ghosts?
Yes.
And the bosonic sign?
Because it's not a unitary theory.
It has the negative energy because we do have, it's a higher derivative theory.
Yes.
So higher derivative theory has ghosts.
So, yes, Bouloir, Desert, and Stellan.
Don't you have Q dagger is equal to H?
Ah, right, but you'll have Q, so you have Q squared, right? But then you'll have a contribution from your ghost, which comes with a minus sign, right? So that gives you an indefinite notion, so you, right? So this is not necessarily greater than zero. So. Anyway. All right, so very quickly then, outlook. So I mentioned a little bit about the log modes. So to refresh your memory quickly, log mode is just some extra solution that has been found. Never mind a consideration for now, but it's some function multiplying the left mover for the bosons. It grows linearly in time and diverges like rho, I suppose. As rho goes to infinity, but yet it seems to be asymptotically ADS if you do the boundary analysis properly. Similarly, we have found a mode with a precisely the same multiplying function out in front that solves the field equations. The only thing that's like kind of up in the air right now is this notion of boundary conditions and doing the same Grumiller and Johansson analysis for the supersymmetric case. But ask me about that in maybe a couple weeks. I'll tell you more details at that point. So another kind of interesting thing to look at would be the partition function for this theory. So in analysis to Strominger, Song, and Maloney, we could attempt to look at. So Witten suggested back in 2007 that there's a supersymmetric version of his J function proposal, right? For what the partition function should be, it should be some unique partition function for low central charge. So it'd be kind of cute to see what the partition function theory from this is, and kind of see if we can come up with some extremal super conformal field theory for n equals 1. And along those same lines, right, there's been this recent proposal about n equals 2 extremal conformal field theories not existing. And this is fairly in-depth and complicated arguing going on, but if we could generalize the TMSG to 2 with 2 gravitinums, or to n equals 2 case, then we might be able to say something sensible about whether or not this analysis left a loophole open, or perhaps we can get a better notion of what an extremal CFT, or what the condition should be for having this pure supergravity or pure gravity notion in three dimensions. And finally, string theory. Does topologically massive supergravity appear in string theory? And if so, is it a consistent truncation of some set of modes, or is that some kind of decoupling limit that we can just zoom away and forget all about the UV completion, have a nice consistent theory at the end of the day? Thank you.
At the chiral point, are the only physical excitations around ADS the descendants of the vacuum?
Around ADS, yeah, because the are you talking topological massive gravity or supersymmetry?
Topological massive supersymmetry.
So we have also fermion superparticles, yeah.
But
yeah, of the vacuum, yeah.
Okay, so this calculation of Witten and Maloney that gave an exact formula for the partition function of presumably goes through here.
To the extent that when they started, they didn't have this chiral point; they just took plane gravity, right? So there's a question of holomorphic factorization.
No, he's talking about the argument that all the Virasoro or super Virasoro descendants would just give you a one loop exactly.
Yeah, classically one loop.
So this
theory is then guaranteed to reproduce the n equals one supersymmetric version of Witten.
It'd be good to check. Outlook.
But the argument goes through, right? I mean, the representation theory fixes it to be one loop, or not?
What do you mean by
that? So Witten and Maloney have this argument that you have all the classical saddle points, and then you have one loop around that,
yes,
and then it truncates in one loop,
yes,
essentially using Virasoro representation theory. I would imagine that would go through replacing the word Virasoro with super Virasoro.
Okay.
Presumably, yeah. But I mean, it has to be. It's kind of a next step.
And it's like the
So are there BTZ black holes?
Oh, absolutely. They're also supersymmetric cases. Yeah, but I believe.
So
it kind of you get like half as many Kimmich spinners or something like that. I'm not entirely sure. I'm trying to remember what the Hano and Kusara, I believe, wrote a paper on that a while ago, and they explicitly spell things out for you.
These ones are in the wrong sector, so it's a supersymmetric theory, so you have different boundary conditions. So he was discussing the Schwarz sector, but the black holes are in the wrong sector of the theory. So it's pretty conceptual. So I think it's really a very nice discussion, and I think Hano focuses on the dimensional gravity, so he discusses where it is in black holes exactly emerge, and where it blocks just this idea solution.
And they're necessarily spinning for the chiral gravity. They're necessarily spinning for chiral supergravity.
In the same sense that like this Krauss and Larson kind of things, you pick up extra kind of deformations of M and J from the topological term. Yeah.
All your favorite BTZ solutions exist for topological S bracket chiral harmonic charges are contributions from the chart sinus. So indeed, the charges look chiral, even if you write down what you would have thought was a non-spinning BTZ one.
Oh, and those, so the supersymmetric ones are going to be like that.
So on the other hand, this like work the ADS are not supersymmetric.
To the best of my knowledge, yeah. Trying to repeat this analysis at a naive level is quite complicated, but.
at least in the 1, 0, there are not supersymmetric.
Yeah, no, certainly not the background, though. Yeah, but I need to plug in this, right?
Yeah.
You know where it is. No. No. This thing? Here. Great. F7? I'm not sure.
Something you need to know.
Nope. Well, I think I did. So you were saying function F7 and that would work, but it doesn't.
Usually works.
Yeah, although I think I might just be something specific to the brand computer.
Yeah. Sure.
Can you bring your computer to
me? Nobody's sitting
out. Wouldn't it be function of something else? Maybe it's about the resolution of the screen or something like that?
Probably the there or there. Those are both open. Or there. I don't know
how to call. Yeah, well, I think I have my presentation in the USB. Excuse me, sorry. Excuse me. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's going to be fine.
There's no
So
do you have Office 2007 libraries?
Yeah. So your work sample's known in relativity.
Here it's much more good. Here it'll work. If I had done slides, it would have been funny. It would have been a week old. Okay.
Apologies for the little technical difficulty, but we are done here.
More technical difficulties, wait a second. Thank you so much for having me here. I need a pointer, is this working? That's cool. So, okay, by this moment, I think we should all be quite familiar with chiral and low gravity. So now I'm going to try to discuss some work we've been doing with Don about the relation between the two theories. So this is the outline. Looks pretty long, but I only have a few slides for each topic. So, okay, since I lost a couple of minutes, I'm going to just put this here for you guys to read this. This is a good moment to leave without making me feel bad. So if you're you can just go. Okay. Okay. So, okay, TMG is a rather old idea. I was born in 81. This was in 82. So, how old? It's known that it's generically unstable, as we have already seen, except at possibly the chiral point, in which it could be stable. So we know that we have two theories in this spatial point, depending on the boundary conditions and on the left charges. And in this talk, we're going to investigate these two theories and see if we can relate them in some specific way. Okay, so, okay. It should say TMG in three dimensions up there in the title. Yeah, well, the action is here. And these are the equations of motion. And we're going to be working around the ADS background in global coordinates. And the symmetries of the theory are two copies of the Virasoro algebra. These are asymptotic symmetries. And these Virasoros include two SL2Rs as exact isometric groups. And well, the central charges are known for the Virasoros. Known and important references are this one here, So Strominger, Song Lee, etc., etc. And the question in my title was borrowed from basically these papers here. Okay. So let me remind you what the linearized theory is around ADS. So we know that the ADS background is invariant under this isometric group, so we can classify the linearized solutions by their weights under L0 and L0 bar, which are generators of the SL2Rs. The linearized equations can be written in this way, where the D's are differential operators that mutually commute with each other. So we merely see from here that we have three branches of solutions. So we can construct the spectrum starting with primaries, which are annihilated by the L1s and L1 bars, and acting then with the descendants. These are the so-called boundary gravitons, the conformal weights of these ones for the primaries. This is the massive mode, which is the bulk degree of freedom. And without loss of generality, we can restrict ourselves to mu greater greater than zero, because, well, we know that the theory is mapped into another similar theory with mu goes to minus mu. You just have to exchange everything and be careful with picking the right normalizable mode. Okay. So up to this point, we don't need to restrict ourselves to mu greater to one. So that's, I just wanted to point that out. We are going to use the symplectic structure a lot during this talk. So I'm going to define the norm of two modes, or inner product there, between psi 1 and psi 2 as the symplectic product of them divided by 1 over 2 pi. And remember that the symplectic structure is anti-symmetric in the argument. So in order to get a positive definite quantity, in the usual cases that you expect to get something positive definite, you need a complex conjugate, right? So a bit of terminology here. We're going to call a mode gauge if and only if it is a degenerate direction of the symplectic structure. It's not enough that the norm of the mode is zero. It needs to have it needs to have a vanishing product with everything else in the spectrum. That's something important to keep in mind. And it's going to be a ghost if its norm is negative, with some convention. So always you can flip the sign and the action and get the opposite answer. But the interesting case is when you have different modes, and some of them are positive, some of them are negative, and so that flipping that sign doesn't resolve anything, right? So under using some conventions, namely keeping the boundary gravitons to be positive norm, this was important here. You know, use the board. Yeah, yeah. See that over there? So if we keep mu greater or equal to 1, we see that the boundary gravitons are normal particles, but the bulk degree of freedom is a ghost because it has negative norm with the symplectic structure. So the theory is unstable. It contains a ghost for generic mu.
Is it equivalent to say that you have a negative symplectic norm or a negative linearized energy in the same statement?
Well, in this case, they are equivalent because this guy here is an eigenvector of L0 and L0 bar. So the energy is proportional to the symplectic product. But for the log mode, that's not the case because it's not an eigenvector. So in this case, they are equivalent, but for the log mode, they are not.
The two are related by a factor.
Right.
So if there's positive frequency, then there's correlation.
Yes, yes. So okay, we have seen that for a generic value of mu, the theory contains a ghost. So we know that the chiral point mu equals 1 is special. So let's try to see what we can say about the theory in this special point. So we have seen that in this value of mu, the massive graviton and the left moving graviton merge, and their norm becomes 0. So we need a new linearly independent solution, right? We have three order differential equations, so we need three solutions. And the other solution can be constructed at this limit for the usual argument. And by explicit computation, you can put the new solution in this form. It has some interesting properties. It has a slower falloff at infinity, namely that it doesn't satisfy the Brown-Hinault boundary conditions, but what would you could call log boundary conditions, just because it has this log. Well, the thing is that they are more general than Brown-Hinault. But despite of this, it's still normalizable, which is that it has a finite norm and finite inner product with everything else. Another way to see this is that you can expand this guy in a Pfefferman-Graham expansion, and the G naught in the Pfefferman-Graham is unchanged. So, okay, this new mode has negative norm as well, right? And it also has non-vanishing product with the psi L. So this is a subtlety, which is, I think, important. Then it's not a subtlety, of course. Okay. So psi L is not pure gauge. It has zero norm, but it's not gauge, because it mixes with this guy in the symplectic structure. So we cannot, in principle, just discard this guy if we are considering the new mode in our theory.
But if you say kind of what you define, to be defined by reaction plus boundary conditions, then...
Right. This is what we are trying to argue in this problem. Exactly, but you're right. And answering also Jeffrey's question again, this mode carries negative energy, but it doesn't follow from this equation here, because this guy is not a separate eigenvector of L0 and L0 bar. It is, though, an eigenvector of L0 minus L0 bar, because it has well-defined angular momentum as required, but univaluedness of the function, right? Mm-hmm.
In order to show the law of mode in chiral gravity, do you have to impose a boundary condition for all time at infinity to kill the law of mode, or can you impose it at a fixed time?
I think we're going to try to answer. The answer is what? Okay, so we have seen that in the chiral point, which is, well, a maybe misleading name, we have two possible theories. One is chiral gravity, and the other one is log gravity, depending on the boundary conditions, but maybe most importantly, in the vanishing of the left moving charges. We haven't seen this explicitly, but it turns out to be correct. If you impose Brown-Hinault boundary conditions, you get just vanishing left moving charges. So let's talk about log gravity. Quite briefly, it's a bit less known than chiral gravity, I think. So we know that it contains ghosts, so it's unstable, but we want to study it anyway, just for fun. So, well, not just for fun, two reasons. So this embedding of chiral gravity in log gravity could actually teach us about chiral gravity. We can learn about chiral gravity studying this embedding eventually. And it's also interesting because it is conjectured to be dual to a log CFT. So that log here is not directly related to the log we found, but maybe all logs are related in some way. So this is how I'm defining the modes. So this I labels which if the mode is left, right, or nu. Alpha and alpha bar label the descendants. So if you act alpha bar times with L minus 1 bar, and alpha times with L minus 1, you get a mode which is like this. And here is a list of the modes that are not pure gauge. So if, for instance, you have psi L and you act with L minus 1 bar, you're going to get something that has vanishing inner product with everything else. Same for psi right. And psi nu, you have to split it in two pieces. This guy only has descendants along L minus 1. And this guy here, which is the so-called GKP mode, has descendants along alpha and alpha bar. We're going to talk about this later. So the relation of low gravity to a log CFT was pointed out by McGreevy during a talk by Andy Strominger at the MIT. And the whole point of log CFTs is that you have this structure, and this is the same that we found here. So if you act with L0 and psi nu, that is not an eigenstate. You get this extra piece here, and psi L is an honest eigenvector of psi L. So in 1993, it was discovered that this structure here leads to logs in your OPEs. So that's, if you see this, you have to keep in mind log CFT. This is the structure that it's present there, it's present here. So it's conjectured that this could be dual to a log CFT. You want to see, you want to read reviews about log CFTs? These two papers are interesting, I think. And well, as I said, this psi nu has well-defined conformal weights. So it was all this bunch of modes, so it don't, they don't contain logs. And by don't, in quotation marks, I mean that the logs are pure gauge in that case. I think I'm running out of time. Okay. So as I said, we have these mixed terms in the symplectic structure. So if you want to study the spectrum of log gravity, it is convenient to diagonalize omega. And we just pick linear combinations of modes. So since the mixing occurs between psi nu and psi L, this psi nu here, this guy here, doesn't mix with everything else. So we're just diagonalizing this subspace. And these linear combinations here satisfy this property. The inner product is actually a delta with a sign that I've listed here. So psi nu has vanishing inner product with everything else, and it has negative norm. And the same for the rest of the guys. So okay, we're going to try to quantize the linear theory, just promoting the Poisson brackets to commutators. And we see that we have two possibilities of quantizing this theory. So I'm saying this because it's folklore that log CFTs are non-unitary, but we can see that we can quantize them, quantize it in a unitary way.
Sorry, mm-hmm. Folklore, you mean there's no actual proof?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It's conjecture, mm-hmm. Not unitary.
The statement, which is often misrepeated, is that a log CFT, which has only highest weight representations, must be non-unitary. And it's often repeated without the qualifier that you're looking at highest weight representations.
And that's, that is true.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you're not looking at highest weight,
right. For all non-highest weight representations, it can be unitary.
Okay, so let's review what a unitary quantization requires. So we're going to find a vacuum state that's going to be annihilated by all the A's. And if we require this, then we need this kind of commutation relation between A and A dagger. Otherwise, we're going to get negative norm states. And how do we implement this? Well, we have to remember that the symplectic structure is the inverse of the Poisson bracket. So that requires a special kind of pairing up between the creation or annihilation operators and the negative norm or positive norm states. So let me remind you that psi 1 has negative norm, so the positive frequency guy has to be paired up with a destruction operator. And the opposite is true for psi 2, which is positive norm, so the converse is also true. So let me also remind you that we have this mixing in L0, for instance, because just psi nu is not an eigenvector, so L0 acting on psi 1 is going to contain psi 1 and psi 2, and the same with psi 2, with specific coefficients there. So if you want to calculate L0 and the quantum theory, well, you just take L0 in the classical theory and normal order the operators, and you're going to get an expression like this. So we know that the theory is unstable, so well, L0 is closely related to the energy, so we expect these minus signs here everywhere. But what's maybe more interesting is that you get these terms here. If you quantize the theory in a unitary way, you see that the vacuum is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, which has exactly the same form as L0, and neither you have highest weight states, because L1 is, of course, going to have the same form, and the vacuum is not going to be annihilated by L1, and there's no simple way, I think, to construct highest weight states as a Fock space construction, just eight daggers acting on the vacuum, because this term here. If you want to proceed in the non-unitary way, you will just exchange A1 with A1 dagger, and you're going to flip this guy here and here, and you're not going to have this problem, but you're going to get negative norm state. So it's up to you in which way you want to quantize it, but you're going to have to deal with different problems in the two scenarios. Okay, so let's try to answer the question, is chiral gravity a truncation of log gravity? And one way to rephrase this, to make this question more precise, is do we get chiral gravity imposing the constraints ln0 on log gravity for all n? If we demand all the left moving charges to vanish in the log gravity spectrum, do we get chiral gravity? So this question is actually two questions in one. We have, on the one hand, the classical question, we have the charges vanishing, and the quantum question is, what are the states that satisfy this constraint? Mm-hmm. So at the linearized level, we can calculate, these are the classical charges, we can calculate L alpha for alpha greater or equal than 2 in norm, and we get that this is proportional to A nu, the coefficient of the log mode. And for instance, L0 is going to have a form like this with the sum here over the quantum numbers. So we immediately see that this condition here implies that we cannot have this log mode, right? And also, if we impose L0 to vanish at the classical level, this guy is 0, so this guy has also to be 0, because this is 0, this is 0. And our mode expansion is just of this form then, just a right moving and left moving. But here's the interesting question, the interesting point, that psi L wasn't pure gauge in the presence of the log mode, but now psi L satisfies this in the truncated spectrum. So we are free to just drop this guy and just keep the right moving boundary gravitons, because the logs are not present because of this condition here, right? The quantum statement at the linearized level is similar, but I'm running out of time and involves things that details, so I prefer to skip it. And the answer to my question at the linearized level is yes, chiral gravity is a truncation of log gravity. And
wasn't you seeing the problem if you kick the model from the very beginning and just say, well, I kick out the massive model, I kick out the left moving model, so then I just have done that from the, so why do I need to go through this argument? So couldn't I just have picked out the massive amount by hand, saying, well, if I take out the massive amount, I take out the vacuum amount, so the vacuum.
Well, in the... What do you call the massive mode? The log mode? I'm doing this in this sense. I'm taking the chiral point limit first, and I get psi nu then. So the massive mode is not there, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So if because we have this mixing between psi l and psi nu in the symplectic products, it's not clear that you can get rid of.
But it's kind of like, what you're saying is kind of like taking out the log mode then. You're kicking out the log mode,
mm-hmm.
and kicking out the
left mode. Right. Yeah. I kick first the log mode, and then I can kick the left mode. Right. You have to consistently remove both. That's what I'm saying.
Well, once the log mode is gone,
right.
The mode becomes pure K.
Exactly. Yes.
Is there a reason to think this would still work if you get beyond the mirror level?
That's the next slide. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm confused. The constraints you impose for what values of alpha?
For all values of alpha.
Positive
here.
And negative?
Yes. Yes.
What about L1? You don't have four.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good question. There's a difference between the SL2 part of the algebra and the other one, or the rest. What is it? So this is your expression for the charges in terms of the symplectic structure. So this is the contribution of this linearized solution around the background G. So now you have to integrate this equation, right? And you take a second variation, delta 1, delta 2, and omega li delta G. Well, H is already varied. So you get something like this. Mm-hmm. Two. And how do you integrate this equation? So you see that if this killing vector here is a symmetry of the background, the full expression for the charge is just this, right? But in the case, this is for n equals minus 1, 0, and 1. But for n greater or equal to 2 in absolute value, the ln is not an isometry of the background. So in this case, the linearized theory just gives you this contribution here, that ln goes as just A is linear in the field, as opposed to the symmetries that are exact symmetries in which they are quadratic in the field, right? So that's the whole point in the difference between L0 being quadratic and L A alpha for alpha greater or equal than 2 just being linear, because the background is not a symmetry of these guys. That, am I answering your question in the right way?
Second question, the quantum level, don't you want to impose some weaker condition that only like the positively loaded modes annihilate the vacuum?
Well, then the theory wouldn't be chiral, right? You have to impose all the left charges to be zero to call the theory properly chiral.
Quantum theory, we impose it in a different way, right? We impose that the overlaps, the inner products is all the physical states are zero and not such a strong operator condition. Like in the string theory. Can we do?
Yeah.
There are many ways to do these things. You're certainly free in principle to impose that all the L's annihilate the state in this context because there's no central charge. So there's no obstacle to imposing the strong condition. You can discuss at more length whether one wishes to or not.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about interactions. So in the minus 4 minutes that I have left, I'm gonna try to finish this. So the classical question that we want to ask is, do all nonlinear solutions that satisfy the constraints obey Brown-Hanau boundary conditions? And the answer is yes. And you can find it in the latest paper by Strominger and fellows. And I'm running out of time. I don't want to say anything more about this. And I'm going to focus on the first step to the quantum answer at the nonlinear level. So one thing that we need to check is that whether we have quantum corrections to the central charge or not. So we can impose the constraints because the central charge is zero, right? If the central charge wasn't zero, we wouldn't be able to impose the constraints, just because L goes like L plus C. So if we were trying to impose L to be zero, this is zero, this is zero, and if this is non-zero, we get a contradiction, right? So the logic goes this way. We're trying to impose this constraint for all n. That implies that the commutator acting on the state has to be also zero, and that implies that CL has to be zero. So we can follow the logic in the other way and realize that this is a necessary condition for this to hold, right? And well, that requires, in principle, a full quantum treatment of the theory. And it was shown like 2 weeks ago by Oda that the theory is power counting renormalizable, so this is in principle possible. But for the moment, I'm going to take a more modest approach, which is noting that the Newton constant is proportional to the Planck length in this case. So if we canonically normalize the quadratic term in the action, we see that the higher orders in classical perturbation theory correspond or can be interpreted as quantum corrections, right? So what would L, say, minus 2 be at the next order in perturbation theory? So we know that, and the linearized theory is just linear in the A's, and so if we expand the action at cubic order, we can calculate L2 with two daggers, right? So we have selection rules that are given by the commutation relations of L with L0 and L0 bar, and for L minus 2 they are just this. These labels are the conformal weights of the A's, right? What I was calling before A nu is now going to be, well, A nu is not precisely this, but this argument I'm just going to use it for generic mu, where everything has well-defined conformal weights. So for instance, the coefficient of psi left would be 2, 0, right? So, okay, we have to satisfy the selection rules, and we see that for generic mu, only the left-moving gravitons contribute. And so we have this constraint here because the ADS background is SL2R invariant. So the left-moving gravitons satisfy this, and this go like the minus n here, n minus 2. So if you act with L1, say, L minus 1, on the background, this is 0. That implies that you don't have states with weight 1, right? That implies that in L minus 2, you don't get terms of the form AA or A dagger, which are the ones that contribute to the central charge. So you can remind yourself how the calculation goes for the, say, open string, and you will see that the central charge arises by these terms in the LNs. Using this argument, we can conclude that for L minus 2 and L2, we don't get these terms, so the central charge at this order is 0, right? Is that clear? More or less? Okay. So we see that the SL2R symmetry protects the central charge because SL2R invariance of ABS3 implies this argument. And we can see easily that the same argument follows for higher order perturbations. So if we have Ln to an arbitrary order, you have a bunch of A's and we have to satisfy constraint like this. And if you look at L-2, you will see that you don't satisfy these constraints for this type of coefficients. So you don't expect corrections to the central charge of this form. Very close to the end. So let me just conclude saying that at the classical level, chiral gravity is a truncation of low gravity, as it was pointed out by these authors here. And the quantum mechanical aspect, the answer appears to be yes, at least in perturbation theory by the argument I just gave. And we have two approaches to understand these problems, which are unitary and non-unitary quantizations. And what remains to be done is to be more careful with the zero points of the linearized operators and the full nonlinear operators and treat other quantum effects, take other quantum effects into account. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So in the string theory on ABS3 with the usual orbifold CFT dual, is there any point in the moduli space where you would get a logarithm? You could have a logarithmic deformation in which maybe some of these questions would be concretely addressed in the string
theory. To be honest, I have no idea. I don't know if anyone else in the audience.
So it's not something that anyone has looked at, as far as you know.
Not as far as I know.
Log definition.
Because you're just coming in from.
You need degenerate sort of primaries, and then I guess if you.
I'm sure you need logs coming in from the scalar fields. I mean, if you could. Well, actually, in that moduli space, now maybe not. I know.
You did that ADS3 right above the freedom.
Yeah, are these scalar sensors in the ADS3 right above the freedom bound in the appropriate theory?
So thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to speak. And I should say that this is based on this recent work with Jeffrey Compere. So the motivation for this work comes from one of the central aspects of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is that deformations of the conformal field theory, say by multi-trace interactions, for example, are supposed to correspond on the gravity side to modifications of the ADS boundary conditions. So the idea is that by finding sort of new classes of ADS boundary conditions, one can hope to obtain new and interesting ADS CFT type dualities. And so in particular, the claim is that for ADS supergravity, there are certain boundary conditions which lead to a dual boundary theory, which is not just the field theory, but to supergravity theory. And so for this talk, I'll focus on the case of a four-dimensional bulk so that the boundary is three-dimensional. Okay, so that's how this is related to three-dimensional gravity. So it's important for choosing boundary conditions on the ADS side to have well-defined bulk theory that the symplectic structure is both finite and conserved. So let me briefly remind you how this object is defined in the standard way. So given some Lagrangian and some fields phi, if we take the first variation of that Lagrangian, we obtain one term, which is proportional to the equations of motion. So the equations of motion are E equals zero. And in differential form notation, there is also, we can have a surface term coming from any integrations by parts that one has to do. Then we define a symplectic current, which you call omega, given by taking the second anti-symmetrized variation of this symplectic potential theta. So and then the symplectic structure associated with some space-like hypersurface sigma is given by integrating this current over sigma. Okay. So for the case of scalar fields, this object is exactly the Klein-Gordon inner product. What I want to emphasize is that generally for gravitational theories, of course, we have to regularize the action of some boundary counterterms so that the on-shell action is finite and we have a well-defined variational principle. Okay, so I'll denote the boundary by this script I. And in general, these boundary terms can contribute to the symplectic structure, leading to what we call the renormalized symplectic structure, which differs from the standard by some extra term d omega ct coming from the presence of these counterterms. So in some cases, this extra term can be important to canceling certain divergences that appear in the standard symplectic structure and rendering modes normalizable, which were previously non-normalizable. So another way to say this is that this potential theta admits some ambiguity in its definition up to some exact form. So in some sense, we are appealing to the counterterms to fix this ambiguity. Okay, so this guy is supposed to be finite when integrated over some surface sigma. And in general, so that the symplectic structure is conserved, we require that the symplectic flux through the boundary vanishes. So after one has done sort of all the renormalizations, what one generally expects to find for the flux is something of this form. Where the pi's are sort of the fields that are canonically conjugate to the fields phi. Okay, and so then one has to impose some bounding conditions so that this flux vanishes. Okay, so to illustrate this and to obtain some results that will be useful when going to the full supergravity theory, let me first tell you a few things about the linearized theory of just spin 3 has Rorita-Stringer fields on ADS space. So we consider this Rorita-Stringer type action. D dimensions for now. And there is some mass parameter M. Okay. So the important point is that this action admits an extra gauge symmetries for a special value of this M, which we refer to as the massless case. Okay, so the transformation takes this form. For some arbitrary spinner epsilon. So of course, this is very reminiscent of a supersymmetry type transformation. And indeed, if you look at the massless spectrum, say supergravity on ADS4 cross S7 or ADS5 cross S5, then you find that indeed the spin 3 has fields have exactly these this mass value. And the same is true for n equals 1 minimal supergravity, ADS supergravity in four dimensions, which we'll come to in a moment. Okay. So we want to analyze normalizability of solutions to the Rorita-Stringer equation. First, let me tell you about the case we're just talking about, sort of the standard inner product or symplectic structure. So there are a lot of similarities to scalar to the case for scalar fields. There are essentially two cases. One case is when this mass is between 0 and 1 half. So the field has some asymptotic expansion near the boundary, which takes this form. So z is my ADS radial coordinate, which tends to 0 near the boundary. And alpha and beta are two coefficients, which sort of two coefficients of the two linearly independent solutions. So in this mass range, both the linearly independent modes are normalizable. So this range is very much analogous to the range at or slightly above the Brayton-Lunger-Friedman bound for scalars. So here one has a choice of boundary condition at infinity. For example, one can impose a Dirichlet-type boundary condition, which you fix the slower fall-off mode but allow the faster fall-off mode to fluctuate, or you can impose a Neumann-type boundary condition, in which you fix the faster fall-off mode and allow the slow fall-off mode to fluctuate, or more generally, you can pose some mixed-type boundary condition where you relate these guys to each other. So for example, in even space-time dimensions, this type of boundary condition works, where gamma d plus 1 is the higher dimensional analog of gamma 5 in 4 dimensions. Okay, so for masses greater than or equal to 1/2, only the faster fall-off mode is normalizable. So here one has to impose sort of the Dirichlet type boundary condition. But the interesting point is that the massless fields, which are of most interest for supersymmetry, are always in this range. So if one wants to have more general Neumann or say mixed boundary conditions, in that case one has to go to the renormalized symplectic structure. So let me focus in particular on the massless fields in 4 dimensions. Where the field now falls off this way. Okay. So now sort of the linearly independent modes are contained in the sort of alpha zero mode and the beta zero mode. This guy alpha one is determined in terms of alpha zero. It's some differential operator acting on alpha zero, and again I remind you that this mode is now non-normalizable with respect to the standard symplectic structure. So if, for example, one wants to impose say a Neumann-type boundary condition, then this requires a boundary counterterm which is roughly of this form. So because this term contains a derivative in it, you can see that it will contribute to the renormalized symplectic structure. And indeed, one finds, if we follow through this procedure carefully, one finds that the alpha zero mode is rendered normalizable with respect to this renormalized symplectic structure. Okay.
Should I have got that, the top line on the right from putting m equals 0?
This line?
Yes, should I have got that by putting m equals 0 in?
No. Because, okay, again, the massless case in 4 dimensions corresponds to m equals 1. Okay. And the other point is that now there's this new term which is sort of in between the alpha and beta modes. Right before, in this case, this sort of new term is sort of subleading. Okay. Okay, so we have checked that this works for a large class of these linearized spin 3 halves theories for a large number of masses and dimensions, and we expect it to work in general. For the case of pure gravity, this was studied previously by Jeffrey and Don. Okay, so the usual story for gravity is that the leading mode of the graviton is non-normalizable, but again, following this procedure of appealing to boundary counterterms to renormalize the symplectic structure, they found that you can indeed define theories in which the metric is can fluctuate at the boundary.
Can you remind me, what's the relation between this and say the right?
Well, I mean, in this case, we're saying that it's normalizable without having to impose a cutoff.
The difference is that when you do Rambles under and you move the brain to the boundary, the graviton on the brain decouples. This is like...
Right, this is as if you're pushing the field theory all the way up past the Planck scales and following the empty stuff.
Some language, but this is, you could imagine cutting the theory off. If you did the equivalent of adding the counter terms that are normally put in at infinity of ADS space on the Randall-Sundin break, then you could set the parameters such that the lower dimensional gravity theory doesn't decouple as you move the brain to infinity. And that's the relationship. So at least as a classical procedure in bulk ADS space is well defined.
And does the other mode become non-normalizable? Are both modes fluctuating?
Yes.
But presumably you have to have some relationship between them for conservation of flux, right?
Yeah.
Aaron will answer this question in a moment. Both modes, it's like scalars near but above the Brayton-Wunder-Friedman bound. They're both normalizable, but you have to do something.
But you choose to freeze one and let the other fluctuate, generally. So that's what you do.
Yeah. Okay.
That's just naive confusion. So the whole ADS bulk has energy scales going all the way up to infinity by the usual UVIR relation.
Mm-hmm.
But when I couple that to gravity, I would have thought that something changes at the Planck scale. Not saying this very clearly, but you have a field theory which is defined all at all scales.
I repeat my comment that as the classical operation is in bulk, this is well defined.
Okay, so you say
in which case,
there
is no Planck scale. Planck scale involves quantum gravity corrections.
Yeah.
So, what happens when you quantize these theories? One can then discuss.
Okay, so, well, in the context of ADS-CFT, this was interpreted as promoting the boundary metric to be a dynamical field. And so varying the metric on which the CFT lives was interpreted, or leads to, I guess it was called sort of the induced gravity of the CFT. Given by integrating the CFT partition function over boundary metrics. Okay. So, and what these guys showed remarkably was that at least for even space-time dimension or odd boundary dimension, that the boundary theories were this ghost and tachyon free around the flat boundary. Okay.
So is there an Einstein-Hilbert term?
So, well, I mean, this will be some very complicated theory, right? We haven't added any explicit gravitational dynamics, but the statement is that if you integrate out some of the original CFT fields, then the metric will have kinetic terms and some non-trivial propagator. I mean, it will be some non-local theory, which is non-local the metric, or there's an infinite series of higher curvature terms.
And the original CFT fields, does that include a stress tensor? Are you freezing the mode that would have been the expectation value of the stress tensor?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, that's one boundary condition that you can impose is to, instead of fixing the boundary metric, you fix the boundary stress tensor.
So, in theory, you're getting, I think, gravity, but coupled to something that does not have a stress tensor.
For that particular boundary condition.
It has a fixed stress.
A fixed stress, but not a dynamical stress test.
Correct. Right. Okay, so now the idea is to extend this to supergravity.
One might just, I mean, Shiraz, it sounds better if you say it this way. The theory has some dynamical modes, but the stress tensor also has contributions from vacuum polarization. The metric is dynamical, which means the metric responds to make the total stress tensor zero. The sum of the vacuum polarization plus the dynamical modes gives you zero. I've merely said your word in a different order.
Okay, so we want to, again, extend this story to supergravity. And so we look at a simple example of n equals 1, minimal. Is for supergravity. So now we want to couple this action to gravity. And the other important point is that this, as we saw earlier, this covariant derivative now contains, the spin connection now contains certain torsion terms. So this action, in fact, contains sort of four fermion terms. Okay. And oh, I should note that, again, as we expected, the spin 3S fields have mass 1, so these are indeed the massless fields. Okay, so this theory is, of course, invariant under standard supersymmetry transformations of the Veilbein and spin 3S field.
Supersymmetry global ADS, what, are there any observables in this? What are the observables in this theory? So the usual correlation functions are not observable. That's fine. If it's a compact space, you don't have S. Your question is as difficult to answer as what are the observables in gravity on a space with compact spatial slices.
Right.
Of course, if you make the boundary ADS or something, there's a boundary on the boundary, then I can answer your question.
Right.
So, because the free energy is a well-defined thing, presumably, or not? Maybe not. But it probably has the usual genes instability. Okay, so it's... Okay.
You ask a boundary of a boundary? No, I don't.
Yeah, you can.
With appropriate boundary conditions.
The
bulk ADS 3 case gives you a nice little theory on the boundaries.
Okay, so the next step is to sort of solve the nonlinear equations of motion asymptotically, doing some Fefferman-Gram type expansion. So we find these types of coordinates convenient. So this guy is order the 2R leading order. And then we expand the Veilbein and the spin 3S field in R. Thank you. Okay, so sort of the linearly independent degrees of freedom, again, are contained in sort of the E0, E3, psi 0, and psi 3. All the other coefficients in this expansion can be fixed in terms of these guys by the equations of motion, though the subscript 3 fields do satisfy certain trace and divergence constraints, which I won't go into.
What did you determine those triangles?
These?
Yeah.
As I said, the coefficients, again, are determined by substituting these into the equations of motion and solving. Mm-hmm.
And the other factors you put in?
I think some of the R dependence, I think, is fixed by supersymmetry, right? I mean, I think that's why there's no sort of psi 1 term. So supersymmetry comes into it as well. What we want to do is then use these asymptotic solutions to find out how the boundary fields transform under sort of the boundary supersymmetry. So, for example, E0 transforms into psi 0. And I won't write all the other transformations out because it's complicated. So the next step, again, is to note that, and I should say that, I mean, you want to choose boundary conditions which are preserved under these supersymmetry transformations, so that we preserve supersymmetry at the boundary. And for that, it's convenient to talk about the stress tensor and the boundary supercurrent. So once again, this action has to be regularized by some boundary counterterms and on general principles. Variation of the regularized action should take this form. So where T is a finite stress tensor, which is conjugate to E0, and J is a finite supercurrent, which is conjugate to psi 0. So computing explicitly, what one finds is that the stress tensor is given by E3, coefficient E3, plus some fermion bilinear terms, and that the supercurrent is given exactly by the psi 3 coefficient. Okay. So this action you can see is appropriate for the Dirichlet problem, where you fix E0 and psi 0. For the Neumann problem, one simply performs a Legendre transform so that the action is stationary under holding T and J fixed. And so in particular, a valid boundary condition, this is for the Neumann theory, a valid boundary condition is to fix T to be 0 and J to be 0. Okay. So it also turns out that T and J transform linearly under supersymmetry, so that this boundary condition is preserved under the action of boundary supersymmetry. So because superconformal symmetry is an exact gauge invariance of the regularized action, what we'd like to conclude is that this Neumann theory is dual to some three-dimensional conformal supergravity theory. So more generally, one can couple the Neumann theory to some boundary action. And if we only consider deformations which are relevant or marginal, then the most general such action that also preserves n equals 1 supersymmetry is supersymmetric, cosmological, topologically massive gravity. Okay, so I won't write down the action because we've already seen it, but again, it contains an Einstein-Hilbert term, a cosmological constant term, a topological Chern-Simons term, the corresponding fermion terms. So then the valid boundary conditions, which give a well-defined variational principle, take this form. So one can also argue that these boundary conditions preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry in general. They only preserve the full superconformal symmetry if you restrict your deformations to just the topological term, which is marginal. Okay. So I guess I'll just conclude and summarize. So we saw that renormalizing the symplectic structure allows modes that were previously considered non-normalizable to fluctuate. And then we use this to extend the standard notion of Dirichlet-type boundary conditions to these more general Neumann or mixed-type boundary conditions where the boundary metric and Rorieder-Schringer field are allowed to fluctuate on the boundary. And so in the context of ADS-CFT, we'd interpret this as, in some sense, gauging the superconformal group of the three-dimensional CFT that describes M2 brains, or coupling the CFT to this N equals 1 SC-TMG. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?